this is that I know what the diagnosis was. I can see the pictures that they took when they repaired the rotator cuff. And I know that after 5 or 6 weeks, I could get rid of this and raise my right arm the way I could raise my left, which I couldn't do before the operation. And it's so different from the mental health challenges, the addiction challenges, the other challenges that we encounter all the time in the other work that I'm doing, that I kind of welcome this sling and this thing I'm going through, because I know there is real light at the end of the tunnel. I want to give you a little disclaimer at the beginning, which is that the title, Difficult People and How to Look Forward to Working with Them, might suggest that at the end of the 20 minutes or so that I talk, you'll all be able to walk out the door and say, the difficult people in my life, I now know how I'm going to look forward to dealing with them and enjoy dealing with them. I guess you can take the word literally, looking forward to dealing with them, as just meaning you can look forward to dealing with difficult people, because they are with us always. The other disclaimer that I want to make really clear from the beginning is that when we talk about difficult people, we need to recognize that there are people for whom we are the difficult people in their lives. My wife had to give me a ride up here this morning because I can't drive as long as my arm's in a sling. And we talked a little bit about what I was going to talk about, and that was one of the points that I made very clear to her, that I recognize that I am a difficult person in some people's lives. And I won't say anything more about why that was particularly relevant. I have two readings that I'd like to begin with. One is from a book by Kurt Vonnegut that I've never read, Cat's Cradle. Maybe, how many of you have read Cat's Cradle? All right, well, great. Maybe during response time you can elucidate further on this, but you may be familiar with this passage. During my trip to Ilium and to points beyond, a two-week expedition bridging Christmas, I let a poor poet named Sherman Krebs head my New York City apartment free. My second wife had left me on the grounds that I was too pessimistic for an optimist to live with. Krebs was a bearded man, a platinum blonde Jesus with spaniel eyes. He was no close friend of mine. I had met him at a cocktail party where he presented himself as national chairman of poets and painters for immediate nuclear war. He begged for shelter, not necessarily bombproof, and it happened that I had some. When I returned to my apartment, still twanging with the puzzling spiritual implications of the unclaimed stone angel in Ilium, I found my apartment wrecked by nihilistic debauch. Krebs was gone, but before leaving, he had run up $300 worth of long-distance calls, set my couch on fire in 5 places, killed my cat and my avocado tree, and torn the door off my medicine cabinet. He wrote this poem in what proved to be excrement on the yellow linoleum floor of my kitchen. I have a kitchen, but it is not a complete kitchen. I will not be truly gay until I have a disposal. There was another message written in lipstick and feminine hand on the wallpaper over my bed. It said, "No, no, no," said Chicken Licken. There was a sign hung around my dead cat's neck. It said, "Meow." I have not seen Krebs since. Nonetheless, I sense that he was my caras. If he was, he served it as a rang-rang. A rang-rang, according to Bokanon, is a person who steers people away from a line of speculation by reducing that line, with the example of the rang-rang's own life, to an absurdity. I might have been vaguely inclined to dismiss the stone angel as meaningless and to go from there to the meaninglessness of all. But after I saw what Krebs had done, in particular what he had done to my sweet cat, nihilism was not for me. Somebody or something did not wish me to be a nihilist. It was Krebs's mission, whether he knew it or not, to disenchant me with that philosophy. Well done, Mr. Krebs, well done. The other passage is a parable from Matthew's Gospel in chapter 13, often referred to as the parable of the weeds. Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, "Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did the weeds come from?" "An enemy did this," he replied. The servants asked him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" "No," he answered, "because while you're pulling the weeds, you may uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, 'First collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned, then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn.'" Now, there's a passage a little bit later on where Jesus explains that for the disciples, who often seem extremely dense when it comes to getting to this point. I wish, and I know this is a UU church, and so we don't have to talk about the Bible, but I wish that he had picked some of the really difficult parables to explain instead of some of the really obvious ones. There are some that I'm still struggling with after years and years and years of reading. What sense did that parable about the servant who rewrote the accounts to not owe people as much money? I wish he'd explain what that meant. So the first thing to think about when we talk about dealing with difficult people is that we can look at their presence in our lives, or our presence in the people's lives for whom we are the difficult ones, as having a purpose. It can be the purpose Krebs served for the narrator in Cat's Cradle. It can be a reminder to us that we're not so perfect. It can be a reminder to us that there are unpleasant things we ought to be thinking about. It can be a reminder to us that no matter how well-intentioned we may be, it doesn't always communicate clearly to other people. Difficult people are everywhere. And the person who I first heard talking about this, and I'm going to get back to him a little bit later, is a retired dermatologist friend of mine who lives in Wethersfield. And he gives a lot of speeches, particularly to medical groups, and he often talks about difficult patients and what doctors can do so that they can look forward to working with the difficult patients. Freda mentioned that Hannah is working with adults who suffer from schizophrenia, and that can be a very difficult population to deal with. There isn't necessarily any easy solution to how they're going to get better, or your relationships with them are going to get better. But one thing that we can know when we are dealing with the challenge of working with difficult population is that the longer we do it, the better we're going to get at it. I remember a few years ago when my father-in-law was living the last year and a half of his life in our home, and he had Alzheimer's, and it was getting more and more advanced. And I recognized at one point that unlike raising my son, who many of you may remember, is now 20, but he was much smaller when he and I used to come here, raising him, where every time I taught him something or showed him how to do something, it would get easier and easier and easier for him to do as he developed the competency. My father-in-law wasn't developing more competence. And what was finally satisfying to me was to recognize that I was the one who had to develop the competence in working with him. So that as I tried to figure out how do we deal with this situation, I realized that he's not going to change. I'm going to do the changing. And in some of the difficult people we work with, it's important not to wait for lightning to strike and something to happen so that all of a sudden they aren't the selfish narcissists that many addicts are, but we've got to figure out how to make the relationship work. I've read a lot of stuff that people have written about how to work with difficult people, and there are 10 rules and 4 rules and 3 rules and all sorts of things like that. I'll throw out a few useful suggestions that came from one article I read. And the title was, How Do You Turn a Tormentor into a Teacher? Recognizing that we can learn from difficult people in our lives, how do we see to it that that happens, that we are able to start learning something? How do you turn a tormentor into a teacher? Begin by asking yourself some questions about who they are and why they behave the way they do. Who is this person away from the setting in which you and he or she interact? See the different parts of the person, a parent, grandparent, friend, dancer, skier, singer, or loved one of someone. Chances are you're only seeing the annoying part of your tormentor. So widen your perspective. What is their positive intention? Underneath the disrespectful behavior, what do they really want? Respect? Independence? Control? Acknowledgement? Attention? You may realize that you have similar goals, though you seek them differently. Ask yourself why you think they behave as they do. It's useful to adopt the attitude that their actions have little, if anything, to do with you. Most people operate out of habit. Even if they don't get the respect or attention they desire, they can't change because they don't know any other way. Maybe it falls to you to help them find it. Suggest ways they might achieve their aims more effectively. What is exhausting to us, I think, in dealing with difficult people is how energy draining they are. There are people who, when I see their phone number appear on my phone, I take a deep breath and say, what is it going to be this time? How soon can I get through this? I am looking forward to dealing with them in the literal sense of the word, but I'm not looking forward to it at all. But they are with us, and we will be better off if we are able to turn that interaction into something that is positive or enjoyable or at least tolerable. So remember, we're doing it for ourselves as much as we're doing it for that person we're irritating. It's kind of like forgiveness, as it often has been said. Forgiveness is far more important ultimately for the person doing the forgiving than it is for the person who is being forgiven, because it allows you to let go of the resentment. One thing that I find, and this is a close call in how you do it, is see the humor in the difficult relationships. You don't have to be laughing at the other person to find the whole interaction humorous. I'm providing housing right now to 25 different individuals, most of whom have serious mental health problems, many having to do with addiction, but many having to do with other things. And there's one fellow who has had a traumatic brain injury, but the person who knows him the best, who's working with him, says that he had a lot of problems before the brain injury. He's a very intelligent man who is an artist, and if you listen to him, he's a lawyer and a doctor and a whole bunch of other things too. But he's also got a great sense of humor. And if I can somehow shift the discussion when he's mad into something that will get him laughing or smiling. And sometimes it's by talking about the absurdity of the situation of the world. He called up one time, absolutely furious, because another person who's working with me had made a marinara sauce and put celery in it. And this guy got going on the fact that he won the contest at the Miami Boat Show for something he cooked, and he knows the marinara sauce only has 5 ingredients, and celery is not one of them. And what do I have to do to get it through that guy's thick head? Does he have to bang it into his head with a 2x4? Well, now, whenever we talk about something difficult, if I can steer the topic onto how many ingredients there are in marinara sauce, I can get him laughing again. And we can go back to that furious interaction we had when this other guy made the marinara sauce with these ingredients that he had to spend time going through and fishing out of the sauce before he could serve it. But when we can laugh, we can deal with his frustration with the guy who's smoking in his apartment or who's eating his food or who is doing stuff in the middle of the night that drives him crazy. But we can get to a... Humor is the greatest antidote for frustration that there is. And it's very important that we be able to find humor in our situations. There have been a few times in my life where I've been dealing with people who I thought were really angry, really frustrated. Everything was going wrong for them, and they seemed right on the edge of exploding, and then somehow they were able to laugh about that situation, about something else, and all of a sudden it diffused the whole thing. So humor, finding a way, and some people are, it's easier than it is with others, but finding a way to lighten things up by igniting their sense of humor can make a huge difference. Recognize, and I'll come back to this again, the difficult people are always going to be with us. And we don't want a society where we fence them all out or fence them all in. We've done that. If you drive up through Waterbury, even now after some of those buildings have been torn down, and you think of all the people who we institutionalized in the late 1800s, the early 1900s in state hospitals because we couldn't figure out how to deal with them, we have a tendency to think, let's just get them out of here. And the parable that Jesus taught was, no, you don't want to pull up the weeds because you damage the wheat at the same time. And you can add to that that we may not be so expert ourselves in figuring out who the weeds and who the wheat are. It's easy when you think about weeds and wheat, but I'm sure some of you have had more gardening experience than I have. I always found it kind of intimidating to be asked by my mother to weed because sometimes I wasn't so sure. And if you're doing something like a flower garden, how do you know what are the weeds and what are the flowers? Because sometimes something has a beautiful flower that is considered a weed in certain places. There's an expression that I'm sure we've all heard and that I think I've been accused more than once of being, and that is a skunk at a garden party. There are skunks at garden parties, and there are skunks at skunk parties, and at skunk parties, they're just fine. And sometimes, if we're putting the skunk in the garden party, we ought to be wondering ourselves, why are we creating this environment for that person to be in? One of the tricks that I'm dealing with and the people I'm trying to house these days is trying to figure out the environment for each one of them where that person can thrive. The fellow who I talked about with the brain injury was in one house, and he lasted there, I think, 3 days. And then he was in another house, and he didn't like the people there, and he lasted there about a week. And then he was in a third house, and two of the people got together and went to court and got a anti-stalking and sexual assault order against him because of some comment he had made. And now he's in the fourth location he's been in since I've been working here. And even though when I see his number show up on the caller ID and I start talking to him, I never know whether it's going to be the threatening person who's going to say to me, "You ever hear of McGurr's House?" McGurr's House was a nursing home in Bellows Falls that was shut down by the state. And perhaps he was responsible for it, perhaps he wasn't, I don't know. But whenever he's really mad at me, he will say, "Did you ever hear of McGurr's House? What happened to them? That could happen to you." And then if I can get back to marinara sauce, I'm okay. But the place where he is now, the two other people he's living with, even though they drive him nuts a little bit of the time, even though he drives them nuts a little bit of the time, he's lasting, and it's working. This is a guy who has been kicked out of every homeless shelter in southern Vermont. He has been kicked out of the homeless encampment in Claremont, New Hampshire, where the homeless people lived, and they had had a very, very rudimentary set of rules for how things had to be done, and they kicked him out. He's been kicked out of every family member's house. He has no other place to go other than shelters he hasn't already been kicked out of, and he's managed to stay in this apartment with a lot of involvement by me and a couple of other people for several months, and it feels like quite an accomplishment. And there are days when if I get in the car with him and we go and do some things, I get to the end of that day and it's been fun because we've talked about art and we've talked about cooking, we've talked about different things, and he has insightful comments to make about other people. And I look forward to those days. So how to look forward to dealing with difficult people is how to look forward to yourself having the resources so that that interaction that particular day will be fun and humorous and enjoyable and tolerable. The most important rule that my friend, the retired dermatologist, says he has three rules for dealing with difficult people that he gives to medical audiences. The first is be kind. The second is be kind. The third is be kind. And that's one of the things that I tell myself. Threats do not work. And yet, the first impulse that I will have is to think, what can I threaten him with? And I have to remember, it's going to get me absolutely nowhere. Be kind just might work. And I would add this, get the person laughing. The final thing that I will say, though, about how to look forward to dealing with difficult people is reserve a place in your life for some people who are not difficult. Reserve a place in your life for people who are, at least at this moment, an unmitigated joy. I come home at the end of a day, or put my phone away finally, and begin talking with my wife about various people I've dealt with during the course of the day. And she will say, "I want some Baby Saul talk." Baby Saul is our middle grandson, and he's 2.5. His older sister, Aurora, is a little over 4, and his younger sister, Leona, turned 1 in September. Their mother, it's all one family, my stepdaughter Ashley, who is a very accomplished woman, very capable, and very busy. Their father is also totally devoted to them, and they are wonderful, wonderful children. I know all grandparents say that, but they are wonderful, wonderful children. And Baby Saul looks out at the world with absolute trust and joy and love. And when there are stories that I can share, with my wife about what's happened today with baby Saul, or with Aurora, or with Leona. That kind of interaction helps to leaven all the difficult relationships. And I'll just give you one little baby Saul, two little baby Saul stories. The other day, his parents had been concerned about the fact that he had a tendency, as two-year-olds do, and people quite a bit older than two do, to grab what he wanted. And so they were really working with him on the concept of you need to ask if you want something. You need to ask. So last Saturday, we take the kids swimming at the Edgar May pool in Springfield on Saturday mornings, and then we go have lunch at April's office and in the lunchroom, and we had some blueberry Greek yogurt, and baby Saul ate his all up, and then he wanted some more. But all the other Greek yogurts weren't blueberry. They were pineapple and different things, which he didn't mind, but he wanted another blueberry. And so he said, "More blueberry yogurt, please." And I said, "Well, there isn't any more." And he looked at me with eyes of absolute betrayal, and he said, "But I asked! He goes with his parents to an Episcopal church frequently, and he may have heard, "Seek and ye shall find, ask and it shall be given." And so he has to know that something's been letting him down. The other thing is that he and his sisters love storytelling, and they love acting out stories. And we were recently talking about the Goldilocks, and Saul has shoulder-length golden hair, and sometimes he says, "Me Goldilocks." So we were telling the Goldilocks story, and Aurora said to me, "Say something rude, Papa Bear." And I said, "Who's been eating my porridge?" And she laughed, and then she said, "Say something rude, Mama Bear." And I looked right at Saul. I stared at him with this very mean look on my face, and I said, "Who's been sitting in my chair?" And then he kind of plaintively said the Mama Bear, as if to reassure himself, but that wasn't the way I was talking to her. Anyway, it's a joy to be back here, and I don't know whether any of what I've offered is useful. We'll have a little response time now, but I want to say, I forget how gorgeous it is to look at these stained glass windows. It is very welcome for me to be back here, to see the friendly faces, the warm place, the thriving congregation, the stained glass, and thank you so much for the chance to share these thoughts with you. And now I'm very happy to respond to things Jim told me to go over there so he can have the wireless mic. All right, good. So, do we have some comments? Just, just to let you know, we only record our sermons. We don't record joys and concerns and response time. So speak.